The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Throughout the summer, Democrats cruelly blocked COVID relief legislation in an effort to advance their extreme left-wing agenda and influence the election. Then, a few months ago, Congress started negotiations on a new package to get urgently needed help to the American people. It's taken forever. However, the bill they are now planning to send back to my desk is much different than anticipated. It really is a disgrace. I am asking Congress to amend this bill and increase the ridiculously low $600 to $2,000 or $4,000 for a couple. I am also asking Congress to immediately get rid of the wasteful and unnecessary items from this legislation and to send me a suitable bill, or else the next administration will have to deliver a COVID relief package. And maybe that administration will be me, and we will get it done. Thank you very much.
Hello, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer standing in for your regular host, Mr. Stephen Flurry, and I bring you greetings from the besieged British Isles, increasingly cut off, or at least until today, increasingly cut off from the rest of the world. We'll talk more about that a little bit later in the show. But first, I wanted to update you, as you just saw, on that omnibus spending bill that Mr. Flurry discussed yesterday. You saw Mr. Trump's comments on it. I enjoyed his last parting shot at the end there as well. He's baiting the liberals there. And he obviously hasn't given up fighting this election and this voter fraud. But it looks like he's threatening to veto the bill. He rightly draws attention to the massive wasteful spending that's included in that bill. And Mr. Flurry talked about that on the show yesterday. These vast amounts of money going overseas into these liberal pet projects and all kinds of things like that. And I think what he's proposing is a lot better than what is on offer. At the same time, though, look at what he's proposing. $2,000 per adult, and just doing some kind of rough back-of-the-envelope calculations, that's somewhere in the region of $700 billion. $700 billion, which, okay, that's a bit cheaper than the current bailout with all of its pork barrel spending. I think that shows how bloated the spending bill that they'd sent through was. If even, you know, you're still spending, you can still give $2,000 per adult and it come out cheaper than that. And I think what President Trump is proposing would be do a lot better at stimulating the economy. If that's what the purpose is, getting things going, you're giving 200,000. Now that really would be big. I've got to be careful on my math today. I was talking about that a bit later. $2,000. That's going to get the economy going much better than a lot of the pork barrel spending and things like that that were in the old bill. So I think it's a much better stimulus bill, a huge improvement. But on the other hand, look at where we've got to now with America's spending. Where is this money coming from? It's not coming from taxation. It's not coming from money that America's set aside. I mean, really, it's not even coming from borrowing. I mean, yes, America's borrowing the money, but who's America borrowing from? Well, for a lot of this extra spending, the extra borrowing is coming from the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve is printing the money and then using that money to give to banks to then go and buy up US debt. So basically, President Trump is promising to print money and then hand it over to the American people. That's our modern politics. That's an improvement over where we were yesterday. I think that shows how bad the state is, that printing money and handing it out to people is an improvement. But that's a kind of a horrifying, terrifying situation when you see where that's led to in the past. And I get why that's appealing. There is a big part of me that is thinking, I wish the British government would offer £2,000 per person. Just give that to everybody. Yeah, let's copy America. You know, that's huge. Now, for somebody that's had their livelihood destroyed in the pandemic, who's had a business wiped out or lost their job, $2,000, that's not a lot of money. Or they've been out of work for 6 months, that's not a lot of money. And that's not going to come close to covering what they've lost during that. But if you mercifully haven't had a big drop in income due to the pandemic, $2,000 per adult, $4,000 for a family, that is a lot of extra money. Coming right from money printing. This is where we are in US politics. Different candidates vying for your vote by promising to print your money. Now, how far are we away from now? Well, vote for me, and after the election, well, I'll give you £1,000 or $1,000, and then another candidate outbidding them. Oh, well, vote for me, and I'll give you two. Well, I'll make it three. We're just going to auction off the presidency through money printing? And this whole situation, it reminds me a bit of... there was an incident in Roman history, I had to look up the year, 193, where the Praetorian Guard auctioned off the emperorship. Okay, well, who wants to be emperor? Whoever's the highest bidder, whoever promises to give us soldiers the most money from all the revenue they get from being emperor, will make them emperor. And they just sold it off to the highest bidder. That's feels a bit like where we're going in the United States. And that didn't end well for the Praetorian Guard and the Roman. It ended up getting the Praetorian Guard wiped out, really. And that whole, the status that they held, getting destroyed. And if we just keep printing money and handing it out to people, that's going to destroy America's economy. And that's going to cause a lot of suffering in America, but around the world as well. So a shocking amount of money being discussed at the moment. We did have a really good article on this subject yesterday that went out in our Trumpet brief. America's COVID bailout is loaded with expensive nonsense. You can get that up on our website, thetrumpet.com. And then that was, I said, was our daily email that went out yesterday. If you're not getting those daily emails, I'd really encourage you to sign up to that. So you could go and read that on our website if you want more. While we're on the subject of money and spending, Grabian put out a video of the top 20 media moments of 2020. It's a bit too long to play on the show. I think it was about 13 minutes. It would take up a very good chunk of the show. But it was a great little video, really powerful, just to put together some of these different contortions and contradictions that we've been seeing in the US media. You know, you'd see these news anchors talking about how violent the anti-lockdown protests are, how wrong it is to be protesting during a disease pandemic. And in the background, you would see people just standing around with American flags. You know, there was no violence on the cameras. In the media, it was there telling you, well, this is violent. And then you see the Black Lives Matter protests, and you see the shops and the cars on fire. And then you see the media, the same figure, same talking heads, talking about how peaceful these protests are and how wonderful it is that they're braving a pandemic to stand up for what they believe in. I don't know if there's ever been a year for 2020 for obvious media deceit. Maybe there have been bigger years for media deceit, but it really seems like it's on display at the moment. So anyway, it was a great little montage. But Sam and I had a good laugh over this clip in particular. One bit that we had forgotten about. This is clip two.
Somebody tweeted recently that actually, with the money he spent, he could have given every American $1 million.
I've got it. Let's put it up on the screen. When I read it tonight on social media, it kind of all became clear. Bloomberg spent $500 million on ads. U.S. population 327 million. Don't tell us if you're ahead of us on the math. He could have given each American $1 million and have had lunch money left over. It's an incredible way of putting it.
It's an incredible way of putting it. It's true. It's disturbing. It does suggest, you know, what we're talking about here, which is there's too much money in politics.
Well, I don't know about true, but it certainly is disturbing. I mean, it is a bit of a laugh. I think more than a bit of a laugh, seeing them seriously discuss this idea, but it does make a serious point. You know, no wonder we're at this situation where we've got a massive debt, when we've got big economic problems, if that's how our media think. I just laugh even harder, or it blows my mind even more when you start to think about how many people would have had to sign off on that clip. Like, okay, there's the two people talking about it. It's not, well, firstly, one person tweeted it. Then you had two people seeing it, the host and the person they're interviewing, and they didn't see any problems with that math. And then you've got all the producers that were involved. You know, they would have been scripts for this. There would have been people making that graphic. I mean, with big studios like that, I bet at least a dozen people worked on that segment. And no one said, hang on, you know, aren't we making some pretty basic math errors here? 500 million divided by 325 million or 350 million, whatever it is, that is not 1 million. Could we be off by a factor of a million here? No one thought that, which, you know, if that's how our leaders think, you know, no wonder we're in the situation. No wonder socialism is. I think that clip explains why socialism is so popular. And I'm not just being humorous. I'm serious. I think it exposes this fundamental lack of understanding of how much wealth there is around. It doesn't completely explain socialism. But you know, that make the idea that you that a billionaire, you could take a small chunk of their income and make everyone in America a millionaire. The left thinks that. That's their view, that you just take a small slice of one rich person's income and suddenly we could all be millionaires. I mean, I don't know. If that were true, I think I might be a socialist. If you could really do that. You know, or you could spend 0.1% of what America spends on its defense budget and make every single person in the United States an instant millionaire. That's the way that's what they were saying. You know, you see all these people, they push all these socialist programs, and you think, well, even if that program was a good idea, where's the money coming from? How can we afford that? How do they even think we can afford that? Where do they think the money's coming from? And maybe this explains it. You know, Hosea says, the book of Hosea talks about my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, and it's talking about spiritual knowledge, and the vital knowledge we need to live a happy, successful life. But in some ways, we've gotten to the point now where we're destroying ourselves just for the lack of really basic knowledge. You know, to these people, it makes perfect sense that if you took a tiny fraction of one rich guy's income, we could all be millionaires. You know, the truth is, if you confiscated the entire net worth of every single American billionaire, everything they owned, everything that their companies were valued at, all those shares, if you just took all of it, you know, how much money do you think you'd get? Maybe would that be enough to make everybody else and everybody in America a millionaire? And of course, confiscating all of their wealth, it's not legal. It's not even possible realistically. They would find ways to hide it. And then you'd also destroy the American economy in the process, because why work hard? Why create companies if the government is going to take all your money? But if you did that, if you confiscated every dollar owned and in every asset owned by America's billionaires, you would have enough to give everybody about $11,000. Just one check for $11,000. Sure, fair bit of money, but that's it. That's the one. That's your one-off payment that you would get from destroying American capitalism. You'd get about enough money to cover America's coronavirus spending. That's how much you'd get. Not enough to make everybody a millionaire. Humanly, we'd like quick fixes, you know, a pill or a vaccine to fix a health problem. And socialism, well, you can have a utopia, just tax the rich. Well, the rich don't have enough money. Even if that were a good idea, you can't make everybody instantly a millionaire by just confiscating their money. There is no shortcut to a happy, prosperous society. It gets back to obeying God's laws and his economic laws and building a society based on that. There's no shortcuts to doing that. But here we're trying to print our way to economic health or confiscate our way to economic health, and it's not going to work. Well, there are so many other pieces of news to get into today. So much going on. Fresh elections in Israel. That's another big headline from today. They're going to their fourth elections in 2 years. At midnight last night, the Knesset failed to pass a budget, and under the Israeli law, after a certain amount of time, if the Knesset can't pass a budget, it automatically leads to fresh elections. And they failed to pass that budget last night. There was a bill that would extend the deadline, give them more time to work on a budget. That bill also failed. So now Israel's defaulting to fresh elections, which I think is fascinating. Now we're looking at big decision times for a whole lot of important countries in the world, biblical Israel especially. You know, those nations descended from Israel in the Bible, Britain, the United States, and Judah, Israel in the Middle East. Big times for all of them. You know, in the United States, you've got the dispute over the presidential election. You know, Bible prophecy tells us Donald Trump will remain president. And if that's new to you, you can go to our website, thetrumpet.com. If you click on the From the Editor at the top right-hand corner, you should be able to find our article pretty easily, where Mr. Flowey goes through and lays out and explains why Bible prophecy says that will happen. But, you know, looking at it on the surface, looking at the way most people look at it, well, Joe Biden is all lined up. He's the president-elect. The way that it's being talked about, the way that it really, you know, on the surface, it looks like it's going. So we're looking for some pretty big, exciting changes in America over the next few weeks. Some fireworks. It's going to be very interesting to keep watching the news over the next few weeks in America. Here in the UK, we've got Brexit crunch time. And I'm going to talk about that a bit more in the second half. But this is a huge time period for Britain at the moment. Are we going to get a real Brexit? Are we going to really leave the European Union? Now, that's the real question. Do we get our country back? This question will be decided over the next few days, most probably. You know, do we get to be a real independent country, or are we just going to be a vassal of the EU, outside the EU, but still ruled by the EU? That's the question that is to be decided in the coming weeks, months, maybe, probably days. And now Israel as well. You know, which way will they go? Now, it does look like the Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, is in a good position to win that election, to come back with even more power in March. The Blue and White Party, the main opposition, the left-wing opposition, they have collapsed at the polls. Their leader, Benny Gantz, has not done very well out of his brief time in coalition with Netanyahu, or Mr. Netanyahu. But it's a long time to March 23rd. I mean, look at all that happened between January and the middle of March last year in 2020. How much could happen in 2021? And there's lots of other political parties in Israel, lots of other potential leaders, blue and white voters. They may well rally behind a different party or a different leader. And so this could be a close call, something really interesting to watch as well. So you've got America's presidential crisis, Britain's Brexit crisis, Israel's political crisis. I mean, again, this is the fourth election in 2 years. They haven't really been able to get a stable government together. Again and again and again, it keeps falling apart. And so much to be resolved over the next few months and weeks. And interestingly enough, something else that's got to be resolved over the next few weeks, and that's Germany. I mean, think about Mr. Armstrong's book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy. He talks about Britain, America. He talks about Israel in the Middle East. Another nation that does get talked about a bit in there is Germany. And it's an interesting decision time for Germany over the next few days and weeks. You know, German Chancellor Angela Merkel, she's been a lame duck leader for quite a long time now. And she's going to be gone in September. They're holding their elections. And nobody knows who's going to succeed her. Who's going to succeed her as leader of Germany's main right-wing party? Who's going to succeed her then probably as chancellor? But we've got an important decision time coming up for that. January 16th. The Christian Democratic Union, Angela Merkel's party, they're going to pick her successor on January 16th. They announced the details a week or two ago. They're going to hold a digital party conference on January 15th to January 16th. They'll have 1,001 delegates get together, and they're going to choose their leader on day two of that conference, January 16th. And the leader of that will be in a prime position to be the candidate for Germany's next chancellor, to replace Angela Merkel after the elections. That doesn't necessarily mean there'll be chancellor or even the chancellor candidate. The candidate could well come from the Christian Social Union, Angela Merkel's sister party. But that will be something interesting to watch. I mean, we're watching for a strong man rising in Germany. That's a really important prophecy that we're looking at. A critical milestone in end time events that the Bible talks about. And, well, none of these men, none of the people that are up as candidates to succeed Miss Merkel are the strong man that we've been watching for. How that might tie in, I don't really know. I don't think that's really clear yet. But you know, January 16th is a very interesting date, one I'm sure you'll hear more about on this show, one I don't really have time to get into right now. But That'll be that could be something interesting to watch as well. So it could be a crucial few weeks for Germany as well. So much going on in the world, and so much that could be decided just in the little bit of time ahead. Well, I wanted to also bring you a couple of stories I've seen recently and updates on China, on the subject I was talking to you about last week, China's infiltration of America. One story that's come out since last week that's been a pretty big story is more's been revealed about Chinese forced labor on cotton plantations. The BBC had an investigation. They found that China is forcing at least 500,000 Uyghurs and other people to working on its cotton field. So massive amounts of forced labor. In the past, we found that at least 1 million, I think some people have said as high as 2 million, are locked in concentration camps in this particular part of China. While now, look, they're saying there's around 500,000 in forced labor on Chinese cotton fields. China provides 1/5 of the world's cotton supply. And so much of that cotton supply is coming from forced labor. Dr. Adrian Zenz, he's a senior fellow at the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation in Washington, and he uncovered a lot of this. He did a lot of this research. That really feels like a foundation we should hear more from, the Victims of Communism Memorial Foundation. But he said, in my view, the implications are truly on a historic scale. For the first time, we have not only... And this, he was talking to the BBC about this. For the first time, we have not only had evidence of Uyghurs' forced labor in manufacturing, in garment making, it's directly about the picking of cotton. And I think that is such a game changer. Anyone who cares about the ethical sourcing has to look at Xinjiang, which is 85% of China's cotton and 20% of the world's cotton, and say, we can't do this anymore. So you've got forced labor in manufacturing, in garment making, in cotton picking. And the report that he helped put together, it goes through and shows the Chinese government forcing labor. You know, it's all documented. There's all these official government reports. In one village, for example, these reports say that people were unwilling to work in agriculture. So then they scheduled some officials to do a follow-up visit for some thought education work. You know, they don't want to work in these cotton plantations. We need to give them some thought education work. And sure enough, after that, they had plenty of people willing to sign up for this. And it does appear that these laborers, they are still paid, but they're forced into this work, and then they're given a tiny amount of money, well below the market rate. But what gets me about this is, you know, we claim to be so much more moral than those in the past. You know, the British Empire especially, you know, they're a bunch of evil colonialists. And why are we so much more moral? Well, the big thing that we emphasize that makes us more moral and them immoral is slavery. Now, they were all about slavery, but we know that slavery is wrong. You know, the British Empire, well, they supported slavery. And the truth is the exact opposite. You know, the British Empire led the world in stamping out the slave trade. I've talked about this before at a whole program back in the summer. And they stamped it out in the Atlantic. You had David Livingstone traveling around East Africa. And then he reported on this vibrant slave trade going on in the Indian Ocean. He publicized that, and Britain was outraged. There was this big response. You know, we've got to shut this down. We can't tolerate this. Britain wasn't even participating in this slavery or trading in it or anything, but just the fact that it existed wasn't good enough. We had to get involved and we had to shut it down. And Britain did. We stopped it with force. And then today, with all of our enlightened views on slavery, what do? You know, remember, it's our enlightened views on slavery that makes us so much more morally superior to those in the past. Well, we look at slavery with China and we just kind of go, meh. You know, we wear clothes made of cotton picked by slaves, shoes made by slaves, or forced laborers at least, and, well, we don't care. You know, you have all of this Black Lives Matter stuff about slavery. And you know, anybody who had a second cousin who once met somebody who had a grandfather that was involved in the slave trade, well, you know, they've got to be erased from the history book. While the same individual might be wearing shoes made by slaves, the British Empire would not have tolerated that. You know, they would have passed laws to ban the import of things of cotton made by slaves. They would have passed laws to try and make through garments made of that cotton was never sold in Britain. And more than that, they would have probably sailed battleships over and made sure that the slavery stopped. And we, where we say that we're so much more enlightened because we care about slavery and we know that slavery is wrong, we don't do anything. Nothing at all. We just, it's just not a big deal. I mean, really, it exposes so much about this Black Lives Matter movement and this leftist movement. It's not about slavery at all. Not about slavery at all. It's all about blotting out the name of Israel. I mean, really, it's, I've got my Bible down here. I mean, it's about blotting out this. Now, I think most of the people involved don't realize that. But that's the truth behind it. Now, the Bible talks about how God has a plan. The Bible is a book about Israel. So much of the Bible is talks about Israel in the Old Testament, the nations of Israel. There are so many prophecies about Israel. And it's not for Israel's benefit exclusively. It's a plan to bring light to the whole world. It's a plan that's about God working with the entire world. A plan that brings great hope to everybody. For the benefit of everybody. But in order to benefit everybody, God was working with these nations of Israel, both anciently and in the modern day. And that plan is described in the Bible. And there's an evil spirit being, the Satan, the devil, that hates that plan, that hates passionately, that wants passionately to wipe it out. And you see it with this Black Lives Matter movement. And you know, if you haven't read our free book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, I'd really encourage you to do that. If you want to see what is under attack by this Black Lives Matter movement, it's that book. It's the truth that's in that book. That will show you what's really being attacked. And it's a truth that just has such great hope, that, and that hope just expands the more you understand it. And one of the things that's fascinating, I've just been rereading our book, Raising the Ruins, and it's really interesting. One of the things I think that's really interesting is just when the Worldwide Church of God rejected what Mr. Armstrong taught, one of the first things they went after was that book, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, changing it and getting rid of it. When the church went off track in the 1970s, one of the first things they went after was that book, the same way again, changing it, getting rid of it. I think the speed at which Satan attacks this book, the regularity that he attacks that book, really shows how valuable and important it is, how central it is to God's plan. So again, I'd really encourage you to read that book, to order that book if you haven't, The United States and Britain in Prophecy, because this is what Satan the devil is really trying hard to wipe out. Now, there's one more article, one more update from China that I wanted to bring just before we have a break. This is from Foreign Policy. China's secret war for U.S. data blew America's spies' cover. They've just got a series of fascinating articles. I haven't had a chance to read part two or three yet. I think part two is probably out already now. But these series of long articles showing that, well, China and America, there's a lot of fighting going on behind the scenes, or fighting's not really the right word, I guess, but covert intelligence competitions and things like that. There's a whole hidden battle going on even at the moment and going back several years. I mean, this article kind of goes back to how starting in 2013, China seemed to know who all of America's agents were overseas. And it puzzled the U.S. intel agencies for a little bit, trying to work out, well, how did they know all of this? But they believe they did it by hacking and harvesting masses of big data and analyzing it. You know, America's got so much data just out there. And then they also, China under Mr. Obama, they hacked the Office of Personnel Management. And that has just a lot of background details on all of America's people working for the government. Now, it doesn't, I don't think it really says, well, so-and-so is working for the CIA, but it gives enough information about people for, you can go through and mine that data and work out who is likely to be an intelligence operative. They quoted William Evangina, who they called in the United States as top counterintelligence official. He said, China is one of the leading collectors of bulk personnel data around the globe, using both illegal and legal means. Just through its cyber attacks alone, the PRC has vacuumed up the personal data of much of the American population, including data on our health, finances, travel, and other sensitive information. And so they've been using that to go after the United States. The article talks about as well how back in 2010, China was kind of shocked to discover just how heavily they'd been infiltrated by the CIA, and that rampant corruption in China made that possible. It made it easy for the CIA to bribe people and then to buy promotion for the people that they bribed. And that a big part of China's anti-corruption drive was all about actually fighting off the CIA. This is why they tried to purge corruption. They were trying to shut this door that they were getting infiltrated under. But this article concludes the Chinese now have had unprecedented insight into the workings of the US system. The United States, meanwhile, was flying with one eye closed when dealing with China, with the CIA's carefully built network of Chinese agents utterly destroyed. The debate over how to handle China would become increasingly contentious, even as China's ambitions grew. So we do have a lot of important domestic news going on within the United States, but America's under attack from without as well, and there are these enemies gathering. It's important to watch them, and we'll talk a bit more about one of them in particular in the second half. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. The world is hopelessly confused about Bible history and prophecy. Understanding the Daniel 2 image could clear up most of that confusion. The Daniel 2 image gives an overview of history and prophecy like nothing else in the Bible. The Bible is a masterful work that should be studied in its entirety. The book of Daniel and the images described therein actually unlock the meaning of the prophecies in the book of Revelation. Our free booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, explains the incredible prophecies contained in these two books. Studied alongside your Bible, this booklet, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, will bring the history and prophecy of your Bible to life. Request your free copy today. There is absolutely no cost or obligation. Email your request to td@kpcg.fm or visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily.
Well, welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. As I said, you could call this the besieged Isles of the United Kingdom. Right now, or at least for the last couple of days, France has cut off our border, the busiest port, Dover. They've cut off all lorries coming through there because of coronavirus. We've got footage here Sam's just put up that you can see, where you've got all of these lorries backed up for mile after mile on one of the motorways. It just keeps going. Eventually, if you're watching on the YouTube stream, they're backed up all the way in one lane. As you proceed down the road, you get two lanes of lorries then backed up together. Then there's an airport that's close to Dover. I'm not sure. It may well be on this video at some point, where they've just turned this airfield into a parking lot, and there are just hundreds of lorries queued up there. And this is obviously having a big effect on shops and on food and on things like that over here in the UK. We'll talk about that in just a minute. But really, you've got a massive own goal here. Here we go. If you're looking at the video stream now, this is the airfield that's just covered with trucks. But it's, in part, this is, I think, a big self-inflicted wound where the government has kind of done this to themselves. And the government was worried about coronavirus. You know, they're still terrified of coronavirus. They were terrified that over the Christmas period, people would get together and spread it. I don't think there's much justification for that, but that was their worry. They were afraid that if they tighten the rules and stop people from mixing over Christmas, that people would just ignore them, and then they'd kind of learn the lesson, well, oh, it's actually pretty easy to ignore these rules and we can keep getting together and doing whatever we want. So they came up with this. Well, we'll start talking about, we've got a mutant strain. We found a new strain of coronavirus. Let's use that to scare everybody. I mean, the word mutant, that's pretty scary. We can say mutant strain of coronavirus. We'll tell them they've got to stay in home, stay by themselves. Otherwise, they won't just get COVID. They'll get mutant COVID. And that's like COVID, but even worse. And then, of course, in doing that, well, France used that as an opportunity to close the border. And we'll talk about that decision in just a second. But in order to make this happen, who have they brought back? They've brought back our old friend Neil, Professor Neil Ferguson, Dr. Lockdown. He was there at the key meeting where the government decided to freak out and lock everything down and talk about this this mutant strain of coronavirus. He was there. And in fact, it looks like he never even left. You know, if you remember correctly, this is the guy who's made all kinds of predictions that have all gone wrong. You know, he made horribly wrong predictions about mad cow disease. For coronavirus, he was saying 400,000 people are going to die. And it was nowhere near that. They took their data and his model. They applied it to Sweden, which didn't have a forced lockdown. And they said, well, that model forecasts masses of deaths for Sweden, which didn't happen. Everything that this guy's predicted seems like it's been horribly, horribly wrong. And then he was caught breaking his own rules. You know, he was there on TV regularly telling everybody how important it was that they stay at home and not see anybody outside of their own household. And then he was off having an affair with a married woman. And so, of course, he was, after that was exposed, he was forced to resign. And there's this particular committee, NERVTAG. Back at the time, journalists asked, well, okay, you said he's stepping down from SAGE, this advisory committee. Is he in NERVTAG? Is he on this other government advisory committee? And a spokesman for the Prime Minister said, NERVTAG is part of SAGE, so the answer is no. Professor Ferguson will no longer attend, participate, or contribute to SAGE meetings. So very clear, the answer is no. He is not part of NERVTAG. Then, when the minutes were published for this latest lockdown meeting and Neil Ferguson's name was on there, well, they asked him again. And the spokesman said, well, I think we previously set out that he continued to advise in his role on SPIM and NERVTAG, given that he's one of the world's leading epidemiologists. But just to state again, he's not attended SAGE since he stood down. So they just pretended to fire him. Everything he predicted was wrong. He broke his own rules. He was forced to then, but instead of being forced to quit, they just pretended that he quit, pretended that he was fired, and then kept on listening to him anyway. And the result is this lockdown that really is being ridiculed around the world. Even those people at the meeting don't really agree with it. The Daily Mail reported that a senior Whitehall source told them that a majority of members believed they needed more evidence before acting. So they disagree with the lockdown. And then this was their senior Whitehall source. They said, evidence is emerging day by day from Public Health England, but ministers have been bullied into action by a vocal minority, probably Neil, which believes that in the style of Corporal Jones from Dad's Army, we should be panicking much more frequently. And then even the Times, they had an article, foreign experts scoff at British response to mutant virus. We've got one of the worst results in the world. The foreign experts, they're scoffing at us. And it is similar in the US. I think, thankfully, you're very blessed over there, if you're over there in the US, to have President Trump and a government that is responding in a sane way. I mean, different states are different. There's some pretty bad state responses. But Dr. Bix is now retired because she broke her own rules. This is what she was saying around Thanksgiving time. This is clip 3.
You need to take it upon yourself to be restrictive. You need to not go to these places. You need to protect your family now and really watch. If your family traveled, you have to assume that you were exposed and you became infected, and you really need to get tested in the next week.
You need to stay at home. You must not travel. And if you travel, just assume that's it, you've got it. That's how dangerous this is. Turns out she left the state to get together with several generations of her family from different households. And then she announced yesterday, she's retiring now after she's been caught out by this. The Federalist writes, the day after Thanksgiving, she was caught traveling with multi-generational family members out of state to one of her vacation properties on Fenwick Island in Delaware. Birx told the American press everyone on the Delaware trip was part of her immediate household, even though those involved lived in two different houses. That was the same that Professor Ferguson used. Well, or maybe it was his person that he was meeting with. Well, we considered ourselves one household. I mean, we did live in two different houses, but we self-identified as the same household. It's just all this lies and hypocrisy right at the top with all of these coronavirus lockdowns. But back to Brexit, back to what we're seeing in Britain, because there is an important story for the world here and a warning for the world here. We're meant to be leaving the European Union in just a few days in the end of the year. And, well, what it looks like is that this talk of a mutant COVID strain gave France an excuse to try and push hard on Brexit. Closing the borders. It seems like a lot of that was all about Brexit. A French official said, well, we could have helped the UK battle COVID. We didn't have to close the borders. We could have helped with this new strain, but you're leaving the European Union, so we had no choice. In other words, well, if you hadn't been leaving the European Union, or maybe if you'd been keeping with a closer deal after the European Union, we wouldn't be doing this. The Times wrote in one of their articles, officials at Downing Street were incandescent, the source added, convinced that the Elysee, this is where the French President Macron is, the French White House, you could say, was trying to leverage the new strain of coronavirus to apply pressure in Brexit negotiations, and that President Macron was motivated by a need to appear decisive in his own votes, to his own voters. So that it's more part of pressure, for a Brexit deal. And so the ports were shut down for 2 days from Sunday night, and I think they were opened up finally the early hours of this morning, this big port. And it's interesting to see what effect this has. I mean, we have a clip of what you got in the supermarkets as a result of this lockdown. We can play some of that images at the moment of this closure, where you've got empty produce, things running out in supermarkets. Now, a lot of that, I'm sure, is because of panic buying. There were stories of people queuing outside supermarkets at 5 a.m. this morning and things like that. There's still things there. And we did have, I think we probably had it worse with the start of the coronavirus with disrupted supply chains and panic buying. But still a big impact. And it's a big impact for something that is really a pretty small-scale siege when you get into what was actually going on. And 80% of the trade at Dover was still going forwards between Britain and France. If a container was traveling by itself, that container could keep going. So if you had a container on a train or on a boat, and then that was coming to the UK to then be picked up, that was fine. What was blocked was lorry drivers coming from the UK going back to Europe. They weren't letting the lorry drivers through, and then, of course, the lorries and the cargo they were carrying. So it was just the cargo that had to come on the back of a truck with a human coming from Britain to France. So that was about 20% of cargo. And lorries could go from France to Britain. But haulier companies, they didn't want to send their lorries and their drivers somewhere where they weren't sure they could get them back. So just that relatively small-scale siege, well, that led to empty supermarket chains, to panic buying, to supermarkets warning that we're going to run out of fresh produce when we open up after Boxing Day, after the Christmas break. We're going to run out of produce. We're going to run out of fruit and vegetables. So, I mean, you get an indication of what a siege can do to a country. Like I said, this was a pretty tiny siege. Maybe 0.1% of like a total blockade or cutoff or something like that. But that already, just 2 days of that, and you start to have supermarkets saying, well, we're going to run out of food. And we've talked about how the Bible prophesies Britain and America are going to be cut off, are going to be besieged. And we had the tiniest taste of that over the last 2 days. And we start running out of food. But like I said, all of this is really about Brexit. This is about Emmanuel Macron finding an excuse to get more leverage on Britain, to try and force Britain to come to some kind of deal with the European Union. And what this does, this exposes the imperialistic nature of Europe. It really shows us something important about the way the European Union operates. And the way the European Union operates with Britain, that's the way they're going to operate with the United States soon. with the world soon. So Britain, we're due to complete our break with the European Union January 1st. We officially left January 1st, 2020 last year, but there was a transitional arrangement. And so that was just temporary, that lasted a year. And the key issue that's at stake really at the moment is European Union's demand for a level playing field. There's lots of talk about fish, and fish is an issue as well. But I think if they solve, it's the playing field that is the real, one of the big real sticking points. And this playing field, it's a thinly veiled excuse to keep the UK under EU control forever. You know, fine, you may be out of the EU, but you still have to live by our rules. That is what is going on with the EU pushing for a deal. In everything that you see, all this discussion about a no-deal Brexit, that is at stake. The EU wants Britain living by their rules forever. You know, the idea of a level playing field, that sounds good. We all agree. Yeah, level playing field. Compete fairly. The idea that Britain shouldn't be allowed to compete unfairly. Okay, that's reasonable. And I guess, in theory, Britain could leave the EU and we could scrap all of our environmental laws and all of our worker protection laws and get rid of minimum wage and produce goods and services at a price that European companies just couldn't compete with and never be able to match. And then for their own protection, the EU would have to put tariffs on. You know, that's never going to happen, though. You know, we have a conservative government here in Britain that wants to ban the sale of petrol cars by 2030. You know, they're not going to turn Britain into a massive polluting China, making things cheaply and out-competing the EU. Yeah, that's never going to happen. And right now, UK and EU laws, they're really similar because the EU has been making so many of our laws in these cases or setting those standards. But the EU is demanding that it stay that way forever. They've got a ratchet clause in their in this deal. So they want Britain to sign a deal that says that if the EU tightens a law, you know, on any of these areas, in employment and in environmental protection, all of these ones, if the EU tightens its law, Britain has to match it. Britain has to follow suit. Otherwise, they'll face penalties. And they're talking about big penalties and penalties on things not even related to what's at issue. So anytime the EU changes one of their statute, and the EU, you know, they've got a mind-boggling array of rules. I should have brought one of those clips that talk about all the different ways and rules they regulate. You know, maybe they change a regulation on milk or on bathroom towels or roads or pay or how much time off people get. Any of those things, and they're saying, well, Britain, if we change that law, you've got to change too. And if you don't, we can put punishing tariffs on you. And so if we agreed to that, it would mean we'd be ruled as if Britain were an EU member, but then just no say in how those rules are set. The Telegraph's Ambrose Evans-Pritchard, he wrote, "The mechanism is intended to lock the UK into Europe's regulatory and governing structure permanently. So we'd give up the right to set our own labour law, environmental law, business policies, even taxation and whether we can give companies tax relief, those kind of things. And then the EU would be the one to decide if we'd done enough to match those laws or if one of our laws broke one of their laws. They would be the deciding ones. They would be the judge, jury, executioner. They would decide if we'd broken it and what the penalty has to be. And there'd be no appeal mechanism. We'd just have to take it." And so far, the Prime Minister Boris Johnson, he's refused to sign off on this. You know, he's saying that it'd be better to leave the European Union with no trade deal and conduct trade with no special treatment. They're still pushing for a deal, but he's at least looking like he's planning on going through with that, and we'll see. But Ambrose Evans-Pritchard talked about how the European Union is trying, in that case, if Britain leaves without a deal, they're trying to make countries make it as difficult as possible for Britain to try and force them to come back and submit. He said, "The Commission is instructing member states to engage in a systemic non-cooperation policy, insisting that the UK must be forced back to the table as soon as possible. Hardliners think the EU will have to accept even worse terms after facing the trauma of port chaos, pauperisation, and further fracturing of the union." And that's really what was going on, I think, earlier in the week with France. It's okay, well, no Brexit, no deal Brexit. You're thinking of going that way? Well, we're going to find an excuse to cut off your port for 2 days. That's what it's going to look like. You know, this mutant strain of coronavirus, it's all over Europe. It's not even unique to the UK. There's no public health reason to cut off Britain. But it does send, it does start to send a message. Well, okay, this is how we're going to treat you if you're going to go with a no-deal Brexit. And Amber Evans-Pritchard, in that article, he talked about the way the EU forced Greece in submission in 2015, and they want to do the same now to Britain. And he argues Britain may be much harder to intimidate, and he may be right. I mean, we'll see how this plays out. At the moment, it's looking like maybe a no deal. They're talking about maybe extending things again. That might happen. There might be an 11th hour deal today or tomorrow. They've kind of put that as a deadline. And if they miss that, they'll probably put another deadline. So we'll see. And maybe if Britain sticks to their guns, they'll get a good deal out of the EU. It's possible, I guess. And that the EU will be forced to back down from these demands in the face of losing a massive customer. Yeah, we'll see. But at this stage, what we can see for certain and what we can say for certain is we can see this imperialistic nature of the European Union. You know, they just can't let go. They can't give back control. You've seen this throughout the whole Brexit process. You can go all the way back to the 2015 and Prime Minister David Cameron. He wanted Britain to stay in the European Union. And he went to Brussels and he said, well, look, there's a lot of people that want out of the European Union. We want to convince them to stay in, but can you just give us some concessions here? Give me something to work with. And I think if the EU had genuinely been willing to give back some powers or to work with David Cameron, Britain probably would have stayed in. It wouldn't have taken much. But instead, they gave basically nothing, just a couple of very cosmetic changes. You know, a lot of people, I think, were in Europe quite excited by the prospect of Britain leaving, no longer gumming up the EU's inner workings, insisting on, you know, sovereignty, slowing things down. So they wanted Britain gone from the government, governing the European Union, gone from a position of gumming things up, and so, you know, no concessions. But they didn't want to give up control. Hence the struggle that we are now, 4 years after the UK voting to leave the EU. And even on something as small as, say, fishing waters, the European Union won't let go. They won't give back control. In his article, Evans-Pritchard, he quotes the chairman of a trade consultancy saying, it gives them everything they need for their manufacturing and agricultural industry and doesn't give us anything we need for services. So even the kind of the fairer deal that Britain is putting forward and says that they would accept, it gives everything the European Union would want. And it gives us, you know, we get a lot of things that we don't. It's just that issue with control. But that's enough. They won't sign off on that advantageous trade deal because it doesn't give them control. And I think we'll see this much more from the European Union in the time ahead. You know, we forecast the European Union will shrink down. The Bible tells us that as well. It gives us a lot of detail about what's coming in the future. But as it shrinks down, we'll see that same spirit. You know, Portugal's even talking about having the EU shrink down. They want to, as the Wall Street Journal put it, slough off the unbelievers. Get rid of some of these countries that slow us down. But as they do that, they'll still want to dominate. They still won't want to give up control. So they want to deprive some of those 27 nations of power, but they won't want to give up their power over them. And that's probably why we haven't seen this shrinking already. You know, it would have been much easier to do that. It's harder to shrink, but keep control over these different countries. You know, there's a word for a government that controls many countries that have no say in how, where their own people don't really have any say in how they're run. Empire. And that's what the EU's fight for dominance in Britain exposes it as. It's an empire. And those imperial ambitions are only going to become clearer now in the months ahead. And Europe, well, it's not surprising. They've made little secret of the fact they're reviving an empire. Otto von Habsburg, a senior statesman for Europe and an MEP, he's very famous for saying the European community is living largely by the heritage of the Holy Roman Empire. The EU is trying to revive this empire. They want control. There's a spirit there, a spirit of dominance that's rising in Europe. And over the break, you saw that that video, Daniel Unlocks Revelation, that ad. Now, there's a series of prophecies in Daniel and in Revelation that explain and expose that empire that's rising in Europe that Herbert W. Armstrong talked about, that allowed him to forecast you would get a trade relationship in Europe that would then try to dominate and rule. And we have a free book, The Holy Roman Empire and Prophecy, that explains these know, explains these prophecies. It explains what the Bible says about this coming empire. It shows how already so many of the details forecast in the Bible have proven accurate, have proven correct. It explains and helps you understand what you see for Europe from Europe at the moment, the behavior that you see. And you know, we get an inkling of how this empire will behave with Brexit. Soon that imperialism is going to affect the whole world. Now, the Bible talks about this European power getting together with China, and it's not a two-day blockade just against Britain with 20% of its traffic at one port. It's a blockade against all of Israel, against Britain and America. You know, they want to force America to submit to their will too. And this is a key prophecy to watch. You know, President Trump, he's going to remain America's president. Pretty soon he will be back. Well, he's not gone, I guess, but he will be much more securely in place for the future, stronger than ever. And I think there'll be a lot of people on the right very excited about the future of America at that point. You know, a massive effort of vote fraud and stealing America will have been defeated. But the Bible tells us God is giving us a temporary reprieve there. He's saving America temporarily. He's giving us a chance to repent, giving God's work a chance to go out with power, to reach more people. But if we don't change, well, he's still working. He's raising up Germany. He's raising up some of these other powers that are out there, and he will use them to punish and correct Britain, America, Israel. And then, you know, he'll do whatever it takes to make us turn to him. That's the positive here. He will bring our nations to him, and he's not going to let anything get in the way of that. And he does have a plan for Israel, for this whole world. And he is going to not let anything stand in the way of that plan and bringing those blessings to the world. Well, that is about all I've got time for. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that. You can email us at td@kpcg.fm. And we'll be back tomorrow here on 101.3 on the FM dial or at kpcg.fm.